on 2FM with Green Firm. Naturally good food packed with protein.
Merci beaucoup, Jenny Green. It might be Bastille Day in France, but we still haven't forgiven Thierry Henry for that handball that broke our hearts in 2009. It's Tuesday, the 4th of July, and this is Game On.
Coming up today, club pitches, but no club sandwiches. The GAA announced new guidelines for the club season ahead.
A number of cases have been reported over the past week, and this has led to some uncertainty and concern that the club championships, which begin on this Friday, could be jeopardised. But the GAA were expecting these numbers.
As Premier League players receive support for abuse, James McLean has his say.
The point I'm trying to make was it leaves a sour taste, you know, in my mouth, because I'm seeing all this support, and again, look, I can't touch on enough, rightly so. But then I'm thinking, well, I've been abused for the last 9 years, and, you know, where's my support been like?
The IRFU agree a pay cut with Rugby Players Ireland. We've Gary Murphy's golf picks of the week, and Ruby might even give us a few tips on the horses.
Game on 2FM.
You can text us on 51552 or tweet at Game On and 2FM. We'll also have Mark Langdon later on the show as Pep Guardiola, Jurgen Klopp and Jose Mourinho have a little rant at each other over Man City getting off the hook. Pep wants an apology. Jose can't understand how you get fined 10 million if you're not guilty. And poor Jurgen is just worried about the financial fair play rules. And it's all kicking off in soccer. As you heard, James McLean had his say, but Marie will start with Old Trafford last night. I mean, is 90 plus 5 equals 95 minutes? How was the 96 minutes in the game?
I text you at exactly 90. When that goal went in, I got out my phone and I sent you a text. I just thought you were going to be cracking up.
Man United are...
I couldn't even answer.
Yeah, that's your thing, Ruby, scoring in the 96th minute.
Not of a 95 minute game. See, look, if you had your super time in rugby, it would have all been over. But no, they didn't. I just can't understand why there's no one punctual. Anyway, United didn't deserve the 3 points. They didn't get them. They only got one. Mind you, Martial should have scored first. And it should have been one up instead of one down. But however, time moves on. They still have Palace, West Ham and Leicester to play. Of course, tonight's match is between Chelsea and Norwich. Norwich are already gone down. It looks a good thing for Chelsea to get the 3 points and cement themselves in third place in the Premier League. But James McLean, he had his say today on discrimination, I suppose, guys. He probably made a point. Discrimination is discrimination, whether it's racial or sectarian, it's all discrimination, and I suppose it all has to be looked into. I don't care what's your take on it.
Yeah, I'd agree with you, Ruby. I think it all falls into the same bracket, of course. There's great movements at the moment for Black Lives Matters, but it's all, for me, it's all education. It's all key to educate people on important things.
So last night he posted a message on Facebook and he accused football of double standards when it comes to racism and sectarian abuse. Then he went on TalkSport this morning and he explained why he took that stance and why and asked the questions about his teammates not supporting him on his stances. So let's hear from him.
Look, I'm seeing all this support and, you know, for McGoldrick, Saha, Sterling and that, and rightly so. Like, I don't want to take away from the attention and the support they're getting, because it's bang on, it's absolutely correct, and so they should. The point they're trying to make was it leaves a sour taste, you know, in my mouth, because I'm seeing all this support, and again, look, I can't touch on enough, rightly so, but then I'm thinking, well, I've been abused for the last 9 years, and, you know, where's my support been? Like, where's my level of attention? And when I say attention, I'm not looking for attention, I'm just, you know, in my mind, discrimination is discrimination, but it almost seems that one holds a higher precedence over another, and that's what irritates me. I'm not asking, looking for sympathy or attention. I'm just asking for equality, and that's it, really. Look, I've been getting horrendous abuse. Like, I've had police at my door with taking fingerprints and that, and taking fingerprints of club officials when I was at Sunderland, because there was balls sent. You know, this has come around to my family home, and I'm having police early in the morning, and I've had letters, and I've had birthday cards, and, you know, horrendous, which has all been very well highlighted, you know, and attention brought to it by myself, but it almost seems to fall on deaf ears. And people say, well, you brought it on yourself, but all this abuse started well before, you know, I've had, like, so I'm only human, like, this is all started all well before I've done anything. And sometimes I get annoyed, and, you know, I am an emotional guy, and sometimes the emotions that get the better of me, and I'll act out. But I'm acting out based on retaliation from all this abuse that I shouldn't be getting. And then the media, they jump on it, and they add fuel to the fire. And then, like, before you know it, my reputation's up in flames, and there's no, and people will perceive me how they do then, just based on what they say in the media. And the media's got a big part to play and how I'm perceived, to be honest.
So that was James McLean there speaking to TalkSport earlier today. As I said a little bit earlier, he posted a message on Facebook. He feels very strongly about the sectarian abuse that he's received. He's spoken about that on numerous occasions, but it was just interesting to hear him calling out the double standards when it comes to the racist and sectarian abuse. And I think in the situation that we're in, it's very strange to see him kind of pitting one against the other, you know, that it's not a united thing, that everybody should be held to account for all the abuse. And I think when you're kind of going down that road of dividing one to the other in this current climate, that it can cause a lot of complications, especially when you're calling out teammates as well.
I couldn't agree more with you. There is no difference. Discrimination is discrimination, and it's probably reflective of society in how we look at each other and what people are prepared to say to each other or shout at each other or write about people. I think people have to be accountable for what they say. And to be honest with you, Marie, a lot of it, I know a lot of it has happened in stadiums, but a lot of it falls back to social media giants who are accountable for nothing.
Yeah, just for me, I don't think he's pulling away from what's going on with Wilfred Zaha or David McGoldrick. He's actually said he believes it's right that they get the all attention, but he's just gone on of 9 years. And you can imagine it, like, just as a dad there, that man has been posted bullets, you know what I mean? He showed some of the, and look, he said that he's no saint. Some of the stuff he has posted is unacceptable as well. But I think, you know, I think just from my own time in England, and I don't know about you, Ruby, I do think, I come back to it, it comes back to education. They have absolutely zero learnings from what went on with our countries, you know. And it's amazing, I'll always go back to Phil Dowson, a brilliant back row player I played with. But I remember him asking me about when Munster sing the Fields of Athenry, and he was there, it's such a cool song, it must be brilliant to have something like that. And you explained the song, you explained the suffering behind it, but he was oblivious to that, hadn't a clue. And they just, you know, they don't teach that. And no matter whether it's England, ourselves, anyone, I think it all goes back to education. I think we need, you know, you heard, I saw Simon Zeebo post a tweet from Michael Holding, the cricketer. And I thought it was just brilliant, just how he spoke so openly about how we have to rethink education and the importance of it.
Is education not parenting, manners, how you educate your children to talk to somebody else? I think it goes beyond education, and I don't know, the past is the past, but it's educating yourself how you behave, how you conduct yourself, what you say to someone, what you write about someone. I think that falls back on every parent.
Yeah, agreed. It starts in the house. But Ruby, we're all affected by outside areas as well. Our coaches, just, you know, it's amazing. Like, I watched that clip of George Floyd with my little girl, and she saw nothing but a man kneeling on another man's head. You know, and then you wonder, how does it go from that innocence to a teaching of hate? And I think we all got to learn. We all have to, like, Marie, you've said it before, silence isn't acceptable anymore. Even myself in general, you have to learn more. You have to be willing to educate. Ruby, I do think it lies with it. I agree, it lies at home when you hear, you know, Zaha was racially abused by a 12-year-old boy. You know, that's a falling down of not only his parents, but the whole society. How do we even get to that, you know?
I don't know, but I'd hate to walk in home having carried on like that as a 12-year-old. I don't think I'd get a warm reception at home. But anyway, Donoghue, those pay cuts in rugby today, any opinion on them?
Yeah, I thought they handled it really well. I really do. I think it was good to see rugby players and the RFU come together. They both understand the current situation. It's tough on everyone, and I think they've found a nice middle ground in that the players are going to take a 10% salary reduction and then a 10% deferral of their wages to the 1st of July to December the 31st, and it doesn't affect players under €25,000. So they would be your academy and development players. I'm kind of glad to see that, because they're your next group, they're the really important people, and you know, you could cut it there and make them take the 10% as well, but some of those guys are really struggling to make it, and they're the ones that are going to be coming through in time.
It seemed like quite a complex process, and it took a while to get there. So you would worry if crowds aren't coming back into games and the IRFU don't have the revenue streams that they had in the past. Will they have to go through this again, and will it be as amicable?
I think you're right, Marie. And John O'Sullivan in the Irish Times wrote a great piece about it today, about the importance of the international fixtures, where the likes of Georgia and Fiji could be back in it. And look, it's brilliant to have a provincial game, and that's great, but that isn't the moneymaker for the Irish teams. We need international rugby.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back to Game On. The GAA today updated their COVID-19 policy, and it could have a huge impact on how clubs and county teams proceed this summer and this autumn coming up. We are joined now on the phone by Dick Clerkin, former Monaghan footballer and also a member of the GAA's COVID committee. Dick, it was quite an interesting development, really, a few of them, but I think the one that stands out for me is that now if a player tests positive, the player steps down and the team can proceed. Tell us about it.
Yeah, evening, Marie. Yeah, I suppose that's the big change. Obviously, the guidelines that were issued a few weeks back in relation to a positive test in the team were probably deemed a wee bit conservative, and the fact that they had to take a whole team down. But I suppose the GAA had no choice other than to do that in the absence of any better information or advice. I suppose over the last couple of weeks, you know, they've taken on board what has happened in terms of the prevalence of instances and how they've been dealt with. And really, like, taking government advice, you know, we're putting the onus in the hands of the authorities and the public health advisors to deem what is a close contact. And it's really only players within the circle or in close contact with that player will have to step down, not by default the whole team and mentors, which was the case up to now.
So if we were just to humanise that a bit, so for example, if Conor McManus was to get tested positive for COVID-19, just an example, then his team, whether it be the club, Scotstown or Monaghan, would proceed without him into the next game?
It would, yes. And as I say, if the player would go into the public health system, as it were, which is the case for any of us out in the workplace or just a normal society, so you go into the contact tracing process, and then the public health personnel will then determine anybody that you have been in contact with, and if they deem them to be close contact, well, then that person will then have to go through the process as well. Now, that may well be some of your team members, but from what we've learned to date, that won't be simply as a result of playing games so externally, because we know there's a massive, and for obvious reasons, there's a massive difference in the transfer rate externally and internally, to the point that it's 20-1. So we haven't had any cases that, because there have been a number of cases, obviously, well publicised, of club players contracting it, and the teams have taken the steps that have been advised. But following that, there was no terms that it was proven that there was any transmission through playing games. So as I say, we're following that lead, and as I say, putting our faith in the public health system to determine that if any other players have to then go through the protocol, but as I say, not by default the full team.
Dick, you're a Monaghan man there. You never corrected me. I said Scotstown, I meant
Contibert.
How are those managers going to feel about it? We'll just say a manager of a club or a county. And now I know this is what ifs, but we are seeing GAA players now. I know it's limited numbers, but testing positive. How are they going to feel about it?
And you're right, it is a what if, and you are playing devil's advocate and look at worst case scenario, like a high profile championship game star player. Now, the odds of that happening are small, close to zero, but potentially it could happen. As I say, but yes, in the same way as if any of us test positive at the minute, we don't go to work, we don't see our friends and family, we go into isolation, and GAA players can't be any different. So, as I say, it might seem tough in the event that might happen, but what's the alternative? You know, there can't be a case of allowing players to play, even though they might be low risk. Like, that's just not happening. That couldn't be countenanced. Could then be a case of that fixtures would have to be delayed to allow things to clear up. But again, clear that out, it's 2 weeks. And even at that, you know, the knock-on effect, it's just colossal. So I think really the message is, Marie, like it has been from the start, look, players really have to be careful. And I know it's, you know, even my own club members probably get sick me going on about it. But really, it's up to yourselves. If you're doing the right thing, if you're not carpooling, if you're not, you know, in close confines with people, you've nothing really to worry about if you're doing the right thing. If you're not, if you've been slack and you might get a phone call that determines that you've been in close contact, well, then you're putting yourself and your teammates at risk. So it's really pushing it back to the individual to do the right thing. And I suppose the GAA, as best as they can, are trying to provide an environment to keep that risk as low as possible. And, you know, everyone's saying it, mate. It's not a zero-risk game. We cannot eliminate this. And the only way we're doing that is just, you know, shut up shop. And nobody really wants to do that. So it's minimising risk as best as possible. But obviously there are scenarios that could be present. You know, no challenges for teams and players. But hopefully that won't be the case.
Dick, you said there yourself that the onus is on the player and the pressure's on people to do the right thing. And it's been fine to now with challenge games, etc. But as the club championships crack up and then county championships come into play, how confident are the GAA that players will do the right thing, that lads who are feeling a little off won't chance their arm?
Well, I think all we can sort of go on, how are you doing, Ruby, is what we've seen over the last 3 weeks since we've come back to play. And like, there has been no hard evidence to show that playing games or the circumstance that we've allowed games to go back contributes to the spread of the virus. So any of the positive tests that have come up within club units, they have come from outside the game. So I suppose you take confidence in what we're doing in terms of limiting access to indoor facilities, dressing rooms, all that sort of stuff is having a positive impact. And hopefully clubs, players, everybody takes that on board and sort of proceeds over the next couple of weeks and months to keep that sort of positive win going. There's no guarantees. As I said, there's no zero risk. All we can sort of do is look back and say, well, that has worked well, and try to, you know, look forward and hopefully things will continue in that vein.
Dick, we are seeing the cases rising again today at the highest number in a month. Are you concerned that if cases still rise and COVID-19 is in the community, the GAA is part of every community, that it will have an adverse effect on fixtures and just GAA activities in general? Like, will you be able to keep going?
And this is personally, Marie, and this is just not speaking, you know, representing the committee here, I'm very apprehensive, you know, and that's just personally because, you know, I think there's an element of complacency, and we've been very fortunate because things have been managed so well from a political level and overall buy-in that most of us haven't experienced this in any great degree, but you don't have to look too far where that things can go very wrong. And to think we're out of the woods, you know, I think it's been a bit naive. And, you know, all this talk about club versus county and all these other old things, chestnuts cropping up, I just find them very frustrating to the point that, you know, if come October or November, the only thing that we're talking about is, you know, the unfairness of the provincial systems and all the rest, and club versus county, I'd be delighted. Do you know why? Because that means the COVID stuff has worked and we've done the right thing. But I think all that talk is too far ahead. I think we have a few milestones to do. We need to get through the training, get clubs back playing for a couple of months and have no step back. And then we worry about all the other stuff in October, November. But I personally would be apprehensive because I think there's an element of we're getting too far ahead of ourselves. Just, you know, reflect on what has worked well, try and encourage everybody to keep doing that, not get too far ahead of ourselves, because things can go back very quickly as we've seen elsewhere, but hopefully that won't happen.
Dick, you've no idea how much pressure you're putting myself and Dunica under. If you could see Marie's face, would you be apprehensive? You're like, you've sucked all the joy out of her that the GAA might be apprehensive.
No, we're not, Ruby. If you remember when we spoke, how long ago now, Marie? Maybe 2 months ago at the start of all this? There was no games, there was no nothing, it was so bleak, it was all the rest. And I sort of said to you, you know, as a sort of advisory group, our job was to try and establish when was the right team and how to get back to playing games. And we sort of done that in the round. Now is the case and try and implement that and just take one step forward at a time. Like, I'm very optimistic it still will play out, but I have to, you know, we have to be realistic as well, you know. Obviously, everyone's buoyant to get back to training. It's great. And I am myself. I'm back playing. We've club championships to look forward to. And if the kids are back playing, it's great. But not to take our eye off the ball. And that's really what I'm saying. Don't be too complacent. So all the things that you've been asked to do, the health questionnaires, the hygiene practices, just keep doing that, because not only will it have a big impact on the player that might miss out on club championship, but a massive impact on the team, because it's such a narrow window. There's no time for clawing things back, you know. So I think just don't be complacent, you know. Be confident that what the GAA is putting out is good, it's well measured, it's as low a risk as possible, but don't take what we have for granted either, and hopefully we can still all have a very good, well, not summer, autumn at this stage.
Dick, you are on the COVID committee, so you do have a huge amount of responsibility, really, because everybody, all the J clubs, you know, they're taking their lead and advice from the decisions that you make. Like, is there a cut-off point? Like, if cases, do you have a contingency plan for what happens if cases still rise?
No, well, we're, as from day one, I suppose, Marie, the outset was we will be primarily dictated to obey, you know, the government and public health advice. You know, so say the GAA didn't have a roadmap that brought us back to play ahead of getting the green light from the government, and it will be thus if things go in a backward step. So if the government in the morning, depending on cases and all the rest, Marie, regrettably make a call that we have to start taking steps back through pubs and all the other things, well, we've absolutely no choice but to fall in line. But hopefully, again, not to talk too far, but these are the things that will happen. People know that, you know, they don't like to talk about it or think about it, but like, we're one of the last things to come back. So sadly, we would probably be one of the first things to get called in line with, you know, bars and pubs and restaurants and things that are only starting to come on board now. But so that's the reality. Like, let's not be naive about these things. And but I think people know that. But I think the big thing is from Gaelic Games that we've learned so far outside is relatively low risk. You know, try and do things sensible. You know, with dressing rooms, gyms, all the inside stuff, which is high risk factor. You know, we don't need them necessarily. They'd be nice to have. Let's think creative ways about how we can have a game without them. Big thing is about now managing crowds and all the rest of the game. So hopefully, the responsibility that has been shown by clubs and players and all the rest will continue now into games, so we don't get complacent and we don't possibly risk a step back. I'm hoping we won't, but again, apprehensive that, you know, that reality is still there.
I think all eyes will be on the club championship games now over the weekend, just seeing what crowds are there and how people are behaving. And then as time goes on, I suppose the rise or the fall in the number of cases will dictate what we have over the next few months. Dick Clerkin, former Monaghan footballer and member of the GAA's COVID committee, thanks so much for joining us.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. Okay, we've a few texts and reactions to Dick Clerkin there. Can't believe the GAA don't think players who train in close quarters is not high risk. Also, dressing rooms remain closed while clubhouse bars can open. An interesting chat, Marie and Ruby. I suppose it's hard to get it right, especially when you see 32 new cases today. But, you know, it's a society thing, like you said, Marie, getting back to normal. Like, if we're having house parties, if we're having people travelling in without quarantine, you know, sport is what we play and what people do. And you would think the players and associates and COVID officers are doing all they can.
It is a really difficult one because, like, they can't go and self-isolate and quarantine and, you know, go into a bubble, really, and just go off and play Gaelic games. People are going to work in hospitals, they're going to work in shops, they're going to work in building sites. So I think the reality is that it is going to be in communities, and when it's in communities, it's going to be in GAA clubs because they're intertwined. It's difficult because we need to get the balance. You know, people love sport, they love their exercise, they need it. It's part of life, and it's also part of the healing, I think, after COVID-19, having something to look forward to. I know all around the country now, like, I've been around the country the last week because I was off on holidays, and everyone's talking about club championship and GAA, and they're so looking forward to them, and it's given them sense of just getting back to normal again. So it's just trying, you know, taking that away without when the risk is still so low. I think that's a bit of a stretch, but I see why Dick is apprehensive, because when you do look around, there are people behaving in ways that is going to increase COVID in the communities.
Yeah. Okay, we'll move on to athletics. Most social runners left out a sigh of relief when COVID led to the cancellation of the KBC 2020 Dublin Marathon. Not Olympian Lizzie Lee, who burst into tears as the target of her grueling training was taken away in May. But there could have been tears of joy yesterday for Lizzie, who joins us now, when organisers announced the details of the KBC Virtual Dublin Marathon, taking place this October bank holiday weekend. Lizzie, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, Donica?
I'm great. I was lucky enough to meet you a few weeks ago, and you were still seething about the Dublin Marathon being cancelled. The news of a virtual one surely is music to your ears, Lizzie.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think for everybody, there's a hole in the calendar, in the running calendar now. We all, you know, it, the October Bank Holiday weekend is synonymous with the Dublin Marathon for runners all around the country. So for Cork, Mayo, everywhere. So I think to have something that we can work towards, I saw the feedback on Facebook when this was launched last night and the comments, it was all people going, oh, we can do this. You know, we can get our group of two or three now that we're training, that we always train for marathons, and we can get that group together and we can do this virtual marathon that weekend. We can get our friends and family out, we can put on our club gear, wear our normal race gear, you know, have people, you know, water stations, kids, nieces, nephews, everything. So I think it's something, it's not going to replace the Dublin Marathon, you know, because there's nothing like the Dublin Marathon, there's nothing like the atmosphere, you know, you can't recreate Dolphin's Burn. But I think it's the next best thing.
So Lizzie, tell us, okay, a virtual event, like for people that don't understand what that means, you know, that they aren't living in the social media world that we're all living in, just explain what people have to do and can do if they want to partake.
Yeah, so you have to register, and I think registration is €15, and for that you get a beanie and a medal, and you then download the app, and you have a choice over the bank holiday weekend of what day you're going to do which distance. So they're incorporating the whole race series, and this is where it's really cool. This is where if you took up running during lockdown for your sanity to get away from your small children, hand up in the air, the sanity part with the small children there, if you did that and you're now up to, say, 4 miles, there's a four-mile distance you can choose. There's the 10K, there's a half marathon, and there's a full marathon. And you can choose which day over the bank holiday weekend that you can run this. And then you log into your app, you bring your phone with you, and you go away and you start your race. And you finish, and your time uploads automatically. And then you're ready. You know, you've finished. You've got it. You've done your marathon or your half or your 4 mile. I think I'll probably target the 4 mile myself because I'm still clinging on to the hope that there's going to be a cross country season at the end of November, start of December. So a 4 mile or a decent fast 4 miler with the lads somewhere around the marina in Cork would probably suit me.
Lizzie, I had it in my head that this was a marathon run on a treadmill. That was what a virtual marathon was. I didn't realise it was not really a marathon at all. It's any kind of distance you want to run, run in honour of the Dublin Marathon.
Well, you can do the race, but I mean, I'd say the majority will do the marathon, Donica, because it's so, you know, everyone was training for this. So hearts broke all around Ireland when this was cancelled. They really did. I mean, I had so many messages that day with just crying emojis and people were sad. So this is something where there's pockets all around the country of people who train for marathons together, that they can actually lace up that day, meet, plan out their exact route, tell their family and friends where they're going to be, to roar them on, shout them on, leave out water bottles, etc., and really make this into a fun family thing, I think. That's how I will approach it anyway.
Lizzie, you mentioned there your small children. I know you have three small children, and I've been trying to get you on the show for a while now, so I'm thrilled you're on, because I have a question that I wanted to ask you. So you do have small kids. Do you mind when people ask you about being a mom and a runner?
I don't, because, like, for me personally, right now, Donica knows this because I ran with Donica last summer while 6 or 7 months pregnant over in Ayamonte. So I run when I'm pregnant and I train and everything. So for me, it's incredibly relevant because during my international career, I've already had, this is my third child. So I went to an Olympics as a mom with a 1.5-year-old. So when I was qualifying for an Olympics, I had just turned around after a pregnancy and gotten fit again. So it's not something a male athlete has to do. They don't have to take a year out from the running to return and try. And I mean, I always say your body grows a human. That's a massive deal. So getting back into elite sport and elite level sport, for me, I think it's incredibly relevant. You know, like Rob Heffernan doesn't have to take a year out for pregnancy. Marion does. So I think that question is relevant. It's not that it's not relevant to ask Rob about his children. It's just that when you're talking about pregnancy, obviously that's a massive deal to a female elite athlete a year away from sport, you know?
It's just the juggle, you know. People always say that they get criticised for, you know, when you ask them about having to juggle kids, and men don't get asked that as well.
Yeah, and there is that. I mean, there is that. And I will usually rock up to the airport for an international with my Irish gear on, and someone will say, "Who's minding the children?" And my response is always, without apology, their father is parenting them for the weekend. You know, because that's what it is.
we were on air here one evening, and I was saying all the things I was going to do for the weekend, and they were all going to matches or watching sport. And somebody texted in and said, "Well, where is she going to find time to do the housework?" But Dunica had said the same, and nobody texted in to ask Dunica when he was going to find time to do the housework.
No, they won't. But I mean, it's. I think we're getting better in that regard. But certainly there is a small sexism there. But to be honest, I'm fortunate in that I am in probably one of the most equal sports that there is. Like the prize money for athletics for men and women, you know, Mick Lahasey and myself will get the same prize money for the same distance. In Rio, watching the track events, there was, equal opportunity, men and women, 100 metre finals, 100 metre, 200 metre women's on the same night. So we're very fortunate from an athletics perspective that it's very equal. And you'll hear the likes of Ciara Magee and people backing that up, that it is. But you do get that attitude about the mom thing. I remember somebody after Dublin saying to me, putting up on social media, that where does she find the time to see her children? I was like, well, I'm gone at dawn and I'm back before they're even awake on a Sunday morning. That's her, you know. But nobody would typically ask that of a male athlete, you know. So there is that.
I have to correct you there, Lizzie. Rachel Blackmore gets paid the very same as I got paid as a jockey. Racing is equal too in terms of monetary gain.
Oh,
everyone gets the same, men and women. But you're running 85 miles a week now. I mean, where do you juggle that in to your live schedule?
At dawn. I'm gone at 7. I'm still breastfeeding, so I'm 7-month-old. So I get up, give her a quick feed. She's brilliant. She pops back into the cot and goes back to sleep. And I head off. And I'm back for 9:00, and that's when my husband's workday starts, and he starts for the whole day then. So I just have, like yesterday morning in the lashing rain, I got up, I was gone by about 6:10, and I had a gym session down in the Leeville Clubhouse, and my 10-mile run done. And that was the way I had to do it, and that's just the way I mean, I was back by 9 this morning, having a really hard session with the lads down on the straight road. The gang who've kept me sane for the last 2 months since we've been allowed to train together. A big shout out to them. Thanks a million, lads. It's all parents.
Given a choice, would you be a morning person or an evening person if you could train at any time of the day?
I used to be an evening person, but as the kids arrived, I became more of a morning person. And now, for lockdown, for example, and I said this to Dunica, I bumped into him a few weeks ago, I said this, it kept me sane. It was my joy and my bliss was putting on my runners at 7:30 and off I go and being back for 9:00, and it kept me sane, and I was just so happy coming in the door, looking at a day of homeschooling and small baby and a toddler and the anxiety that we all had for lockdown. But for me, going running, it's not a chore, so I'm just going to fit it in whenever I can, and if that has to be early in the morning, that's what it'll be.
Lizzie, thanks so much for joining us on Game On. If anyone would like to find out more about the KBC Virtual Race Series, they can go to kbcdublinmarathon.ie. Lizzie, hopefully see you out on the track soon.
Yeah, brilliant. Thanks, Dunica.
Game On 2FM.
Now, welcome back to Game On. We're all talking about Manchester City's European ban being overturned. I think I was waiting to see how all the managers would react, and lucky some of them have been out in the media today. Let's hear from Pep, Jurgen Klopp and Jose.
Incredibly happy for the decision and show that all the people said about the club, it wasn't true. And defend on the pitch what we want on the pitch.
I don't wish anybody anything bad and stuff. I said I'm happy that City can play Champions League, but I don't think it was a good day for football yesterday, to be honest. Just because I think FFP is a good idea. It's there for protecting teams, protecting the competition. That was the idea in the start, that nobody overspends, stuff like this, that clubs can, before the season, can have to make sure that the money they want to spend is based on the right sources, let me say like this.
It's a disgraceful decision, because if Man City is not guilty of it, I think to be punished with some million is a disgrace as a decision. If you are not guilty, you are not punished. By the other way, if they are guilty, you should be banned. So it's also a disgraceful decision. So in any case, the decision is a disaster.
Now, that was Pep Guardiola, Jurgen Klopp and Jose Mourinho speaking there. Now, we're joined on the line by Mark Langdon of the Racing Post. I think, Mark, that they all reacted the way I was expecting them to react. But the big question is financial fair play in tatters now? Is that it done?
I wouldn't go as far as saying it's done, because I think for the vast majority of teams, it has worked up until, you know, a point. And I think that, most, I would say, managers, club owners and teams are relatively happy with it. Jurgen Klopp there spoke about how he fully believes in FFP. Arsene Wenger has spoken many times about how he's sort of lost the faith a little bit in more recent times, but he was another one that was a very big supporter of it. I think that this is I think it was Jurgen Klopp called it a bad day or whatever. I definitely think that it was a really bad day for UEFA. They staked a lot, really, in terms of reputation on kind of, you know, nailing a really big team and getting them kicked out of Europe for a couple of years, and on, you know, technicalities as much as anything else, that it was deemed, that evidence couldn't be proven. Whether it's in tatters, I think, will depend on what happens now. Do we see Manchester City, Paris Saint-Germain just go and spend whatever they want, whenever they want? Or will they sort of, you know, still look to play within the rules? So it was definitely a bad day for UEFA. I wouldn't go as far to say it's in complete tatters, though.
Has Jose Mourinho slightly missed the point? I mean, City got fined $10 million for failing to cooperate with the investigation. They didn't say they were guilty of anything. That's what they fined him for. Is his point slightly irrelevant?
I mean, Jose Mourinho's got it completely wrong, as you just alluded to. Manchester City were fined for not helping with the investigation. They made it very difficult for the organisations to kind of have a look at their accounts and everything. And that's why they were fined 100%. It's nothing to do with what they were guilty of and what they were not guilty of. So not for the first time. I think we know what Jose Mourinho was trying to say there, and not for the first time. He's kind of missed a point, but made his point, if that makes sense. I think what he's trying to say is a bit different to what he's actually said. I think he feels quite angry about the decision. And of course, there's a lot of teams that stood to benefit from City being knocked out of the Champions League. You know, that fifth spot was still very open, and it's going to hurt at least one team, and I think it depends which team that is. If it's a Leicester City or a Wolves, then you might not hear too much about it. If it's a Manchester United or Chelsea, then the row will probably rumble on well into the summer.
What does this mean for football? I know it's kind of hard to sum it up, but even just, for example, this morning, for the first time in a long time, when the transfer rumours were kind of put out across the internet, there was a huge amount of players now being associated with moves to Manchester City.
Yeah, I don't think it's good for football, and I say that, you know, as somebody that can fully appreciate what Manchester City do on the pitch, but I think when you get countries buying football teams, that's not a good place to be in. And we've already got sort of two with Manchester City and Paris Saint-Germain in terms of the Gulf states. We know that Saudi Arabia, the Saudi money wants to buy into Newcastle as well. I don't think sort of turning that kind of the sport washing and, you know, just turning it into their own kind of plaything is the right way, for football to go. And Jurgen Klopp, I think that was his main point, actually, in his press conference. His main point was that he comes from Germany. They have a very different model and different approach in Germany, and he believes that that approach is the right way. It's very much about sort of fan ownership. Fans have a say in clubs, and you can't just go to a Bundesliga club and just buy them. And the fans don't want that. They'd rather be less successful, not have a De Bruyne, not have an Aguero, not have a Raheem Sterling, and actually have more of a say and an input into their team and the way that they're run. It's a very different attitude to a lot of sort of Premier League teams. It's all about spend, spend, spend. But I think that's where Jurgen Klopp was coming from today.
Mark, when you look at it, though, like from a club's point of view, it's different to FIFA. Like, financial fair play, has it run its course now? Do they need to rethink it and, you know, come up with a new fit-for-purpose way?
Yeah, I mean, that has been mentioned, particularly by people that were involved in the initial process in setting up financial fair play. Not surprisingly, I suppose, you know, when you've got the lawyers involved and sort of the clubs and the stakes that are involved, people are looking at how they can, if not break the rules, then sort of push them to its absolute limits. And, you know, that there may well be a different way of doing financial fair play. I still think that for the vast, and I'll say it again, for the vast majority of teams, I think it has helped them. You know, at the real top level, you're not seeing quite so many, you know, go and do absolutely crazy things. But then you'll get somebody like Roma, for instance, who sold Mohamed Salah on the sort of basis that they were about to break financial fair play rules. They lost their best player. He was sold to Liverpool. He's done amazing at Liverpool. For Roma fans, they could be looking at that and thinking, well, you know, this isn't right. How can we, you know, abide by the rules, lose our best player? And, you know, they've never really recovered from selling him. So I think that I'm not clever enough to know what the solution is, unfortunately. I wish I was. But I definitely think that they're probably needs to be a new look at financial fair play.
Hopefully they will. Mark Langdon, thanks a million for taking our call.
Now it's time for golf, guys.
What's that?
Now it's time for some golf. My new favourite sport.
You're all excited now because you happened to watch the golf last weekend and Colin Morikawa and Justin Thomas served up a cracker, so you think you're a golfing expert. So, with you, introduce Gary Murphy there.
Gary Murphy, absolutely enjoyed Sunday no end. You know the way we were talking, Gary, about how it was a good opportunity to get new fans for golf during this lockdown when there was nothing else on? Well, I am one of those people. I loved Sunday evening's playoff.
You could go to a tournament now because you could socially distance. You'd be the only one there, Marie, so it'd be grand.
I wonder if I could get an accreditation for a tournament. Look into that. Sorry, Gary. Sunday, it was a great day of golf. Tell us about it.
It was. I wouldn't say it was a changing of the guard, but Colin Morikawa, who has burst onto the scene, he's only been a pro wet week. This is his 24th start as a professional, and he's had two wins. He actually played in Carlton House in 2018 in the World Amateur Championship, which I went down there, and you could just feel that, you know, there's going to be, well, not that you could feel, but they were the best amateurs in the world, so that's where the next top pros are going to come out of. And so far, it's been Morikawa and Victor Hovland who have really kind of shone through of those two. They've both won on tour. And then we've had two winners on the European Tour out of that 2018 Eisenhower Trophy. But Morikawa just looks a sensational player. Now, you have to say, Justin Thomas did give him a lot of help. He was three up and three to go and let it slip, and he'll be very disappointed. But it was super exciting Sunday night.
Morikawa became only the second player in PGA Tour history to record his second professional victory before his second miss cut. The only other player to do it was Tiger Woods.
Yeah, he's a Californian as well. So I think we're saying, even in his interviews, even since he's come out on tour, like one of the most exciting tournaments was last season when Matthew Wolff got his first win and he beat Morikawa down the stretch. And these young fellas just seem to have, you know, an air of confidence about them, a kind of a want to be the best that they possibly can. Because it's very rare that top amateurs make the transition as seamlessly as some of these young kids have into the professional ranks. And the thing about Morikawa, it's ball striking. It's just so rock solid. He doesn't really have any major deficiencies in his game. There's been a huge amount of hype about DeChambeau and his body shape and swinging it like a steam train. But this guy seems to be a much more rounded player. I would personally think he would have more longevity in the game because I think DeChambeau might burst at one stage from blood pressure, if nothing else. But he looks like a superstar in the making.
Speaking of longevity, Mark Warren revived a career that was on somewhat of a downward curve in the Austrian Open the other day. The Scottish player had first European Tour win since 2014.
I know Mark quite well. I was working the Scottish Open last year and I went down on the range on the Wednesday to see Justin Thomas hit the ball live because I'd never seen him hit it live, and he was beside McIlroy. And I watched that and that was quite impressive. And then I was just walking down the range, and Mark Warren was there, and I just sat chatting to him and watching him hit balls for about 40 minutes. And I mean, he's a phenomenal player. He's just been in a position where he's lost a little bit of confidence during tournament play. It kind of kept seeping into him, and I think the lockdown has helped him massively, and he's got his golf mojo back. And he actually didn't even have a caddy last week. He was carrying his own bag. But it's a huge win for him because it's a dual-ranking event between Challenge Tour and Main Tour. And it now gets him back from a situation where he wasn't really going to know when he was going to play. He couldn't plan a schedule. He's into every golf tournament now for the next year and a half, and he's kind of back on the horse again. And, you know, and it could be kind of Indian summer for his career, because he's still only 39, but he could have easily have just fallen in between stools and you know, had a nothing year this year, because that's what it's going to be for a lot of guys, because they're not going to be a huge amount of starts. But Warren is kind of back where he belongs. He's now a four-time winner on tour. He won the World Cup with Monty for Scotland. He's always been a quality player, and he's a cracking lad. He's a big Rangers fan, and we've had good banter over the years with that. And I'm delighted for him.
Gary, looking ahead to next weekend, Tiger Woods is back. He's going to make his first PGA start since February at Memorial, and he's in a nice group as well with McIlroy and Koepka.
Yes, you know, there are all these new names and new kids and DeChambeau, but the big chief is back, Tiger's back, and, you know, he will always be the biggest draw in golf whilst he's still playing. He hasn't played since February. He won in huge style in Japan before Christmas. And from what I've seen on social media, and, you know, he seems to be fit and strong and ready to go. And as always with Tiger, the reason for his greatness, every time he teed it up, he was ready to play. So he might be a little bit of value this week. He's won five times around there. I know it's 2012 since he last won in Muirfield, but the faster conditions this week might suit him, because iron play, the greens are going to be quicker. Iron play is his forte, and it's just great to see him back, and I'd love if he could get in the mix at the weekend with some of the younger names and maybe show them a thing or two.
Shane was tied 39th last weekend and four under par, Shane Lowry, and he's been drawn in a group with Phil Mickelson and Justin Rose.
Good draw for Shane, and it's been mentioned in the press quite a bit how he hasn't really been getting good draws, which he should be because he's the Open champion. And that might inspire him a little bit. It is a good draw. I think Shane has just been kind of ticking along nicely without getting the most out of himself. He's not been finishing his rounds off on the greens, and that can seep down and lead to a bit of frustration in the rest of your play. But he's, you know, mad keen to try getting those playoffs, and he's down the rankings at the moment for that. And this will be a good week to, you know, to get back at it. It's a reduced field, 120. Plenty of points and cash on offer, so hopefully Shane can have a good week.
Gary, I know we're tight in time, but Rory, all five chasing him down for world number one ranking, can he hold on to it this weekend?
He's good form around here, Donnick. He's played it eight times. He's been in the top 10 50% of the time, although fourth is his best finish, so he needs, you know, somewhere around that will keep him at the top of the rankings unless someone Ram maybe wins, which is more than possible. But I expect a good week from Rory.
Hopefully he will have a good week, and Shane maybe too. Gary, thanks a million for taking the call.
Wait a second, before we let him go, we have to ask for his tip for the week.
He gave it to us a minute ago.
Ram, Rose and Ben Ann, they're my three.
There we go.
Yeah, we can't have a week without Mystic Murphy's tips.
I was listening to his tips. He did give us one a few minutes ago, Marie.
Thanks, Gary. Speaking of tips, Ruby the Oaks.
I think Kay and Pepper, Dunica, will probably be the one for me. There'll be no Peaceful or Love. Fancy Blue is only 50-50, so if you're sticking me for one at the minute, I'd be going for Kay and Pepper. But what about the score at the half-time in the championship? 7-0.
Is it a rugby match?
No, in the soccer championship. Wigan are beating Hull 7-0 at half-time.
Those lads are on holidays already, aren't they?
Holidays. That's more than holidays. Incredible stuff.
What do you say at half-time there?
Ah, sure, here. How would you go out in the second half 7-0 down? How would you even face into that? What would the equivalent be in rugby like?
No, we've been there, getting hammered by New Zealand. I remember Brian O'Driscoll asked the referee what's left, and he was there about 25 minutes and we were losing by about 70 points, and he was any chance he could blow it up early, he was there, I can't, it's on the telly.
No, that wouldn't. That would have been a big help if you could have. The Euro Bank Open is also on the European Tour this weekend, where Niall Carney and Gavin Moynihan represent Ireland. That's in Austria as well before the European Tour moves to the UK next weekend.
Exciting stuff. Yeah, we have a Wednesday legend to look forward to tomorrow. Maggie Alfonsi, World Cup winner for England, is chatting to us, so really looking forward to it. Tara Stewart's up next.